Okay, everyone, so let's start out with the suttas. Get this roughly right. And so as I was saying yesterday, the idea with this retreat is to kind of try to trace how the Buddha himself reached awakening, to look at some of the things that he did before his awakening. And that's why the title is How to Practice Like the Buddha to Be. So get some inspiration from the Buddha himself and his practice. And as usual, we're going to follow the idea of the gradual training and the Noble Eightfold Path in particular. So we're going to start out with looking at right view, which is the foundation for everything else. And once you get right view in place, then the rest of the Noble Eightfold Path kind of unfolds naturally as a consequence of that right view. So this is the idea behind this. A couple of the suttas I'm going to talk about here were actually suggested by someone from who's actually participating on this retreat. And sometimes it's nice to get some suggestions because then you kind of bring in some new material as well on this retreat. Instead of having the same suttas again and again and again, you actually bring in some new things, which always is inspiring. It makes you look at the suttas in a new way, and it kind of adds some perspectives from what you normally have. There was one person who said she was very disappointed that I didn't have. There was one sutta she really liked and was disappointed about that. And that's very, very sweet to say that. And I really appreciate that, actually. But at the same time, I think it's nice to have a bit of variation as well. So those suttas that are missing out this year, they will no doubt come back again next year or the year after or something like that. It's always recycling the suttas. Let us get started. Actually, I'll just get this little machine out as well, because there's more stuff on here. So the very first sutta we're going to have a look at is called The Crossing of the Flood. And this is found here. You see the little references there, Sanyutta Nikaya SN11. This is the connected discourses of the Buddha, the first chapter and the first sutta in that chapter. So the very first sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya. And that's kind of interesting, because you can expect that if you have a whole collection of suttas, that the very first one is going to be interesting, because the first one kind of sets the scene. It kind of lays down the foundation for everything else. So the first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya middle length sayings is very, very interesting, because it's a very profound sutta that kind of sets out the idea of right view. It's called the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the root of all things. The same thing in the long discourse of the Buddha, you have the Brahmajala Sutta, the Brahma's net, which kind of sets out the views of the world, and then the in contrast to the views of the Buddha. And this sutta here is similar. It sets out a kind of idea of right view about the path. Crossing the flood is the name of this particular sutta. So what is this flood that we are supposed to cross? The Pali word for flood is oga. I don't know if you have. Do you have that in Sinhala? Oga? Oga, flood? No, don't have that in Sinhala. Okay. Anyway, the Pali word is oga. It's like a flood. It's like a river or a stream of some kind. That probably also is not just a stream, but also a powerful current to this particular stream. And in the suttas, the thing that is known as a flood is basically the sensory world, the sensual existence, the five senses. This is the flood, according to the suttas. And this is one of the things that you will see again and again in the suttas, the idea of the five sense world being called a flood, being called a stream, a current, a river, called a swamp. That's another word for the five sense world. A swamp is something that you are stuck in, very hard to get out, like treacle. You're kind of halfway up to your knees in the swamp. You're kind of striving to get out, but it's very, very hard to get out. And so it is the world of the five senses and the sensuality that actually goes with that world of the five senses. This is the idea of the flood here. So in what sense is it a flood? What does it actually mean? And what it means is that is when you look inside of yourself and you look at your mind and you look at the restlessness of the mind, you look at the agitation of the mind, you look at the craving of the mind, it is like you're always driven onwards, always moving towards something else. Not necessarily having any purpose, but moving on and on and on in the world. Usually just going in circles, usually not having any real goal, any aim, or anything like that, but always driven on somewhere. And this is the flood in Buddhism. It's the mental flood, the craving, the current of craving, always moving onwards and onwards and onwards, without goal, without purpose, without endpoint, without any real aim, in this whole, with this whole flood. And so this is kind of the idea here, the flood of the sensual world. And so one of the main purposes of the Dhamma is to overcome this flood, to cross it, to go onto the far shore and leave this flood behind. And this, in many ways, is the most difficult thing to do in the Buddhist practice, because the five sense world, it is, we are so trapped in this world. Everything we know in our lives really is about the five sense world. You wake up in the morning, the five senses are there. Everything you do throughout the day is really part of that five sense world. So many of the things that we are concerned about, we care about, our families, our work, our partners, our hobbies, almost everything we do, the pleasures that we have in life, is somehow related to that five sense world. And because it is so all-encompassing, because we are so immersed in that five-sense world, it is very hard to extract ourselves from that, because basically it is what our lives is about. This is why it is a flood. This is why it is so hard. This is why it's called a swamp, because you are really stuck in this thing. But for the path of the Buddha to work, you have to extract yourself at least a little bit from that world. And as you extract yourself from that world, that is where meditation starts to happen. Meditation is the opposite of the five-sense world. Meditation is about being peaceful within. It's the opposite of craving, the opposite of desire. And that is why the gradual moving out of that world is completely necessary to achieve something far superior on the Buddhist path. As long as you're trapped in that world, you're kind of going downstream. And where is that down? Where are you heading anyway when you're going downstream? Driven along by this flood. Where exactly are we going? And this, the place we are going, this was a sutta that I read out at Dhammaloka a while ago. I was talking about this at Dhammaloka Center a while ago. And where we are going, according to this sutta, we're going to this pool somewhere downstream. And in that pool, what do you have in that pool? You have sharks, crocodiles, not fresh water, but saltwater crocodiles, the really bad ones. You have sharks, you have whirlpools, and you have all of these kind of scary monsters in this pool downstream. So the sensual realm is fraught with danger. It is fraught with problems. You have no idea where you're going. You can't really see where you're going. It feels kind of pleasurable. You're sailing along on this flood, on this current, on this river, and you're kind of enjoying the view, enjoying what you're doing. And before you know it, you're heading for these whirlpools, these sharks, these monsters downstream. That is the problem with the Oga, the flood of sensuality. You have no idea where you're going. Actually, the results are often very painful and very problematic. So this is the problem with the sensual world. There is another kind of also flood that is kind of partly relevant here, and that is the flood of the sense of I, the sense of identity that we have. That is also a kind of flood, because our sense of identity is obviously very, very important to us. That is also a flood, because it kind of carries us along. If your identity is challenged, you become restless, you become agitated, and all of these kind of things. So our identity is also a kind of stream that kind of drives you on. It is always related to craving, to clinging, to attachments. obviously, right? It has to be related to attachments, our sense of identity. And that is the kind of the secondary flood. First of all, you overcome the flood of the sensory realm. And the second flood you overcome is the sense of identity. And sometimes you also overcome these things in a little bit in parallel as well. So we want to cross this flood. And so the question is, how do we do that? What is the method for crossing this flood? And this is what this little sutta is about. And it's kind of fascinating, yeah? And so let's just see what it says. So I have heard. This is Bhantasujato's translation. So I have heard. At one time the Buddha was staying near Sarvati in Jeta's grove and at the Pindika's monastery. Then, late at night, a glorious deity lighting up the entire Jeta's grove went up to the Buddha, bowed, stood to one side, and said to him, "Good sir, how did you cross the flood?" Yeah, so we have the standard kind of opening of the suttas. And then, you know, the Buddha staying at Sarvati Jeta's grove. This is where he stayed most of the time. And then at night comes this deity lighting up the entire Jeta's grove. And this is kind of nice. The deities are coming to hear the Dhamma. Yeah. And usually what happens if you have a deity coming up, coming down like this, what would you do if you saw a deity coming down, lighting up the entire Jhana grove? How would you feel? Would you feel kind of, wow, what's going on? This is really cool. Yeah, this is scary. Maybe you think, well, God exists after all. Like, I'm no longer a Buddhist. I'm a Christian from now on. That would be kind of a natural reaction, right? Because you see this awe-inspiring thing. And this is actually what you see sometimes in the suttas. You see kind of some kind of very powerful deity coming down, visiting the monastics or visiting other wanderers or whatever. And all these wanderers, they become converted to this deity and they kind of bow down. They say, oh yes, I'm now, you know, you please tell us what to do because you are obviously God the Almighty or whatever. It's very easy to be kind of overpowered by the splendor of some of these things. And of course, the point from a Buddhist point of view is not to be take these things too seriously. The fact that something is powerful and beautiful and amazing doesn't necessarily mean there's a lot of wisdom there. Wisdom may still be missing, even though something is very powerful and attractive in this way. So don't be too quick to bow down to those deities when they, I don't know if they will come here to Jhana Grove, we'll have to see what see what happens. But again, it's this idea of being circumspect, of looking deeper into the matter. Yeah? So here the deities recognize the Buddha as the one who is wise, and they come to the Buddha. It's kind of nice, isn't it? The deities come to the Buddha. They bow down to him. It's kind of something very nice about that. Of course, the whole idea from a Buddhist point of view is the idea that the Buddha is the teacher of gods and humans. Yeah, the Buddha has a wisdom that goes beyond the wisdom of any deities, the wisdom of anything else in the universe. The Buddha is beyond that. And of course, when we look at human history, human beings have always worshipped gods, and there's been a deal, a kind of covenant between the gods and human beings. If you protect us, if we kind of pray to you and we give some oblations to you, then please protect us in return. And this is kind of the always how human history has unfolded in almost all cultures, the idea of a deal between the gods and the human beings. But in Buddhism, it's the other way around. The Buddha is beyond the gods. The Buddha has a higher kind of wisdom. The Buddha is really on top of the world. And there's something very, to my mind, very powerful about that, yeah, because it says something about the potential of human beings. The Buddha was a human being, and the Buddha, as a human being, was able to perfect the state of being a human being. And of course, all of us, we have that potential inside of us. Every one of us has the potential to become more wise than whatever gods there may exist in the world. Yeah, and there's something very, attractive about this idea. It's very down to earth. There's nothing kind of supernatural about it. It brings you down, brings you back to humanity, to what we have in front of us, instead of some kind of metaphysical idea, whatever you want to call it, about the world outside of us. And humanity is sufficient. This is where you can find the highest wisdom. And every one of us is capable of that, if we really get on this path in the right way. So to me, this is very attractive. And it says something about the Buddhist teachings. Down to earth, grounded. It's about what is in front of us, not something far away and distant and very hard to understand. So he goes, this deity goes to the Buddha, and he asks, "Good sir, how did you cross the flood? How did you overcome sensuality? How did you overcome this sense of self that always gets in the way, that is always problematic?" And then comes the interesting answer from the Buddha. And this is what he says. He says, "Neither halting nor straining, sir, I crossed the flood." Neither halting nor straining. Neither stopping nor striving onwards, I crossed the flood. And this is almost like, I would say, almost like one of these, almost like a koan in a sense. The koans that they have in Zen Buddhism. Because how can you get anywhere if you neither halt nor strain? Surely you have to do one or the other. What else can there possibly be apart from halting and straining? And there are some suttas, this is one of the suttas, but there are some other suttas as well that have this kind of a mysterious feel to them. This kind of idea of something impossible. And you look at it and think, what is going on here? It is almost like an impossibility. And of course, that is where when you come across something which seems impossible, that is where a deeper understanding becomes possible. That is where if you kind of drill in and you hone in on those things that seem very strange and very unusual, if you kind of figure out what is going on, that is where a deeper understanding of the matter is possible. And there are a few suttas like this. This is one of those where you have a kind of a conundrum almost, something that is a little bit difficult to understand. So what exactly does it mean, neither halting nor straining? And the Buddha continues. So then the deity says, "But in what way did you cross the flood, neither halting nor straining?" The deity is probably a bit baffled by this. How is this possible? And then the Buddha replies, "When I stood still, I went under, and when I strained, I was swept away. That is how I crossed the flood, neither halting nor straining." So when you stand still, you went under. In other words, when you stand still, you go under, and then of course, once you go under, you are carried away by the flood. You disappear under the surface because you're no longer making any effort to stay on top, to float or whatever. You disappear into the current, and then you get carried away. And then the other one is that when you are striving, or you are as it says, is straining, you are swept away. Because when you're straining too hard, the current kind of gets hold of you, and it takes you away. You lose your foothold or whatever, and you get swept away by the current. So halting and straining are two sides of the same problem. The flood gets hold of you and carries you away as a consequence. And that is exactly what we want to avoid, because that means that you remain in the sensory realm. So halting here, what does that mean from the point of view of the practice of the spiritual path? Well, halting means that you stop making any kind of effort. You stop doing anything at all. You stop to consider the Dhamma. You stop to reflect on what is going on. And you just stop entirely. And when you stop entirely, of course, the world gets the better of you. And you get trapped by the world again, because the spiritual path is no longer unfolding in the right way. Yes, the world gets hold of you, and then the flood sweeps you away as a consequence. But when you are straining, it's a similar kind of problem, because the idea of straining is very similar to the idea of craving and desiring and doing things in the world to get some kind of purpose, to get some kind of goal. And that when you are doing what is similar to what is happening in the world, when you are driven by things, by achieving some kind of exterior aim, because you're doing what is similar to the world. Again, you are trapped by that flood of craving and desire because you haven't really come out of it. You haven't really seen an alternative approach to how to practice the spiritual path. Yeah, because a spiritual path is not really about straining here. When you look at the spiritual path, especially what we're trying to do in meditation practice, and this is many of the things I was talking about yesterday, is the idea of becoming peaceful. And the idea of becoming peaceful is the opposite, really, of straining. If you strain, you will never achieve that peace. And so you will be dragged along by the flood instead. So what does it actually mean then? What is it that we're supposed to do? If you neither halt nor do you strain, what is the alternative? And the alternative, of course, is to use the wisdom faculty to understand what is going on. And that understanding is what actually makes the path happen. And this is precisely why right view is at the very beginning of the path. Right view is at the beginning because right view is the same as understanding. Right view is the same as using wise reflection, yonisomanasikara. Right view is the same as investigating what is going on. So right view is at the beginning, and that gives you the direction of what you're supposed to do. So our job, therefore, is to actually, first of all, understand this idea of right view. And the more you have internalize the right view of the Buddha, the more you will have a sense of direction in your own life in practicing this path. So that is what it is all about. Getting the right view and then purifying that right view, building it up again and again and again. Because right view is something that actually develops on the path. Right view is not the yes or no idea, yes you agree, you don't agree. Right view is something that gradually becomes built up inside of you. And the more right view you have, the more natural will be the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path as a consequence of that right view. So right view is absolutely foundational for what is going on. And so sometimes when we think about right view, sometimes we think that, you know, right view means, yes, I agree that there is rebirth. Yes, I agree with the idea of karma and these kind of things. But actually, it is not as simple as that. It is not really about just agreeing or disagreeing with something. It is about internalizing something. It's about changing your psychology. It's about learning to feel the world, experience the world in a new way. And when you experience that world in a new way, it has to be felt, right? It's important to feel these things because it is feelings that drive us on the spiritual path. It is feelings that make us act in the world. It is a sense of we always respond to feelings. If you look at dependent origination is Vedana Paccaya Tanha. It is from feeling, Vedana, that Tanha arises. Tanha is the driving force that drives you on in the world. And again, in the spiritual path, it's exactly the same thing. When you feel that right view, it becomes part of who you are. You understand it in a very deep way. It becomes visceral. That is when it makes you act on the Noble Eightfold Path and you practice accordingly. So this is why the idea of right view is so profound and why it is so difficult and why we need to contemplate it again and again and again, and you need to use it in your daily life as you're practicing the path, as you're doing things, as you are trying to live a moral and good life. You use yonisomanasikara all the time, and every time you use yonisomanasikara, the wise reflection, then you are on the right track. You're helping the right view to inform the choices that you're making on the spiritual path, trying just to live morally and all of these kind of things, and then you're heading in the right direction. One of the suttas that I often bring out on these retreats, not this retreat because I have to make a few changes as I mentioned before, but one of these suttas is found in the Anguttara Nikaya 2s. Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses of the Buddha, and the 2s is the second chapter of the numerical discourses. And in this sutta, it says that there are two powers. One is the power of reflection, paccavekana bala, and the other one is the power of development, the bhavana bala, two powers on the path. Now the first power, the power of reflection, what does that do? The power of reflection, when you use it in the right way, is the power to live morally. Yeah, you reflect on the idea of the moral life. You reflect on the idea of the power of kindness. And by reflecting on this in the right way, you become a moral person. So reflecting in the right way, this is about wisdom power again, right? This is what I'm talking about now. By reflecting in the right way, you become a moral person. And you become a moral person in a very deep sense, through your actions, through your speech, and even how you think about the world, becomes part of this moral outlook. Your generosity, all of these kind of things. But it's reflection that is the critical thing. Not using willpower to be kind, not using willpower to stop yourself from doing the bad things, but reflecting in the right way. Yeah. So again, this idea, not striving to be moral, but instead using the wisdom that comes from right view to guide the mind, turn your mind in the right direction so you can live a better life as a consequence. And this is kind of very counter to how many people think about morality. Morality, we often think that we have to strive, we have to kind of shut out the bad qualities of mind and force ourselves to be kinder. But no, that's really the wrong way to think about it. You need to reflect, why should I be kinder? Why does kindness matter? And the reason why it matters is because it actually helps you to move forward on the path. It helps you to achieve more happiness in life, to overcome suffering, all of these kind of things. And every time you forget about it, you take one step backwards, you are destroying a little bit of the potential for that path to move forward. That is why the morality is important. Yeah, you reflect on it, you understand what is going on. Then morality happens as a consequence of that. It's a natural thing emanating from reflecting in the right way. And then once you have established that morality, that sila in the deep way, then the second aspect of these powers is the bhavana bala. The bhavana bala being the power of development. And that is the meditation practice. So based on sila, based on kindness, based on living in the right way, meditation happens based on that. That is what you need. These are the two powers. There is no need to speak of any powers beyond that. You can, but these are the two fundamental powers on the path. Reflection and development of the mind through meditation practice. Virtue and then meditation afterwards. So this is what we are seeing here. Yeah, you don't halt, nor do you strive. Instead, you reflect in the right way. You think about the world in the right way. You develop your right view. You understand things differently. And as you do that, you're moving forward. You're crossing the flood as a consequence. So the deity then replies, after the Buddha says that is how we cross the flood, neither halting nor straining, the deity then responds, after a long time I see a Brahmin extinguished, neither halting nor straining, he's crossed over clinging to the world. This deity is so happy to have met the Buddha after a long time. He's probably been seeking to find the Buddha for a long time. Finally, you see a Brahmin extinguished. The Brahmin extinguished, of course, is the Arahant, is the fully enlightened person. The reason they are called Brahmin is because in ancient India, the Brahmins were supposed to be the highest caste according to the caste system. But the Buddha redefines the idea of what the Brahmin means. Instead of a Brahmin being the highest caste, in the Buddha's terminology, a Brahmin is just the best kind of person. So a Brahmin is like the Arahant. That's why we use this kind of word here. And by neither halting nor straining, he has crossed over clinging to the world. In other words, by having right view, by reflecting on the world in the right way, that is ultimately how you cross over clinging to the world. And clinging to the world is basically means that you are attached to all of these things in the world, all of these things that you're holding on to. Emanating from the sense of self, it means giving up the sense of self. That's really what it kind of comes down to ultimately. And this is what this deity says. This is what the deity said, and the teacher approved. Then that deity, knowing that the teacher approved, bowed and respectfully circled the Buddha, keeping him on his right before vanishing right there. So, there you are. That is the little sutta on crossing the flood. Beautiful little sutta and very kind of interesting, because you really have to draw out the meaning of what is going on here, but nevertheless fascinating. So we have now established that the idea of right view or right outlook is the path forward on the Buddhist path, or the way forward on the Buddhist path, because that is the foundation for everything else. If you get that right, then the path will just unfold naturally. So now we're going to carry on with the idea of right view. And I'm going to start with one of many suttas. This is a beautiful sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings of the Buddha, known as the Ariya Pariyesana Sutta, the Noble Search. Noble Search Sutta, and this is where the Buddha compares his own life before his awakening to this noble search, searching for something special, something noble, something really worthwhile, something higher than what ordinary people look for. This is the idea of the noble search. I don't know, I like this idea of the noble search. Searching, a search that is noble. Of course, the idea here is that there is something called the ignoble search, which is the opposite of the noble search. And the ignoble search is really searching for things that don't get you anywhere, searching for things that keep you trapped in samsaric existence, searching for things that ultimately lead to suffering. In other words, searching for suffering really is the ignoble search. And this gives you an idea of what the noble search means. The noble search, that means really the search for real fulfillment, real meaning, real happiness. In other words, something really worthwhile. Something that gets you out of the problems of the world, resolving the problems of the world. That's the idea of the noble search. And of course, it also includes the idea of a noble character, because you need a noble character to be able to practice the noble search. And what is a noble character? Well, it is a character that has good qualities. A character that is kind, considerate, caring, that avoids all the bad things in the world. This is the idea of the noble character. And the idea of being a noble person is actually something very, very, very attractive. At least I find it extraordinarily attractive. The idea of being noble, there's something beautiful about that. And of course, in the suttas, the noble people are the people who are on the path to awakening. The people, the stream enterers, the non-returners, the once returners, and the arahants, those people who have the full insight into the teachings of the Buddha, these are the noble people. And why are they noble? Well, they are noble because for them, a lot of the practices that we are trying to do, ordinary people are trying to do, they have already internalized that. So they are moral, they are kind by nature. They no longer have to try to be kind because they have become noble. Nobility is kind of part of their character. So for everyone who is not yet an Arya or a noble person, we are striving, in a sense, to kind of get to that same point where this becomes part of our character. We are searching for that nobility through a noble practice. This is what this sutta is about. So let's have a look at this in a bit more detail. So this sutta then is found in the Majjhima Nikaya. These are the middle length sayings of the Buddha, and it is the 26th sutta. And if you're interested, you can look this up yourself. What we are looking at here is only an extract of quite a long sutta, but it is the extract that kind of concerns the idea of right view. Because I'm focusing on right view, I've taken out this particular part. Sometimes if you read the whole sutta, there's too much information for kind of having a neat progression through a long course, and so I take out some of the extracts instead. But actually the whole sutta is very beautiful and very worthwhile reading. Yeah. So this is what the Buddha says. He says, good mendicants, it is appropriate for gentlemen like you who have gone forth in faith from the lay life to homelessness to sit together and talk about the teaching. When you're sitting together, you should do one of two things. Discuss the teachings or keep noble silence. So here, just to give you a little bit of background to what is happening here, the Buddha has gone to a hall, and inside this hall there's all these monastics, the monks, specifically sitting inside and having a discussion. They're talking about the Dhamma, talking about the Buddha, or whatever. And then the Buddha comes from the outside, and is approaching this hall. They can hear the discussion going on the inside of the hall. So the Buddha goes up to the door of the hall, and then he waits for the discussion inside to die down. And then when the discussion outside dies down, then he knocks on the door. Right? And then when he knocks on the door, the monks from the inside, they come and they open the door for the Buddha. And of course they say, please come in, Venerable Sir, or whatever. And it's kind of a very, it's very interesting to see how the Buddha is acting here, right? The Buddha is being extremely polite. He doesn't just rush into the hall and say, I'm the Buddha, so please be quiet and listen to me, or anything like that. Instead, the Buddha is humble. He's acting like anyone else. He's just using the ordinary politeness in society, acting in the same way. And this is so beautiful. Here is the greatest spiritual genius in human history. Here is someone who has achieved the highest thing any human beings can possibly achieve. And yet he's acting in a very humble way. There's no sense of entitlement. There's no sense that I am special, which precisely you wouldn't expect, right? If there's no ego, how can you have the feeling that I am special? The Buddha is acting with the politeness of ordinary people, waiting outside until the conversation is gone, then knocking on the door, waiting for them to open the door. And if they want to listen to him, well, then the Buddha will speak. But if they're not interested in what the Buddha has to say, the Buddha will remain quiet. This is how you see the Buddha throughout the suttas. And this is such a good example for all of us to remember that regardless of our status in the world, regardless of who we are, we should never really think that we are entitled to some kind of special behavior from other people. We should actually just live in the right way with the ordinary politeness in society, regardless of how powerful, regardless of how wealthy you are, regardless of how spiritually attained you are. This is the right way of living. Because the Buddha does it in this way, we should follow that example. And it is very important, actually, because we all know that in the world there are so many people who feel entitled. There's so many people who think they don't have to follow the norms of society that everyone else has to follow. And we see this certainly in the world of politics, but we also see it in the world of spirituality as well, where some people feel that they are somehow superior to other people. But the Buddha is not like that, and that's extraordinarily inspiring and interesting. So then they invite the Buddha in to the hall, and then the Buddha says to them, it is good that gentlemen like you, the Pali word is kulaputta, and I think gentleman is an acceptable translation, maybe gentle. Well, this he's talking to the monks, or gentlemen works, but it could also be gentle people or gentle women or whatever you would like, because it's just a general appellation for people of a certain status in that society. And who have gone forth in faith from the lay life to homelessness. And here the important point is that you have gone forth in faith. You don't go forth for any old reason, but you have a sense of faith or confidence in these teachings. And when you have that sense of faith and confidence, that is when you go forth. And only when you have that faith does it make sense that you're going to practice in the way that the Buddha is suggesting. Because that faith means you will listen to the Buddha and you will practice in accordance with how he teaches. So faith and confidence is actually fundamental to these Buddhist teachings. What does the Buddha say here? Yeah, if you listen to the word of the Buddha, are you taking it seriously or not? When the Buddha says there is rebirth, do you think, the Buddha is just taking on the kind of the cultural accretions, or is that just kind of the way that society was functioning? Or are you thinking, well, if the Buddha says so, I should take it seriously? And I would say that it's fascinating, because very often we talk about, well, what is the evidence for things like rebirth in the world? And very often we bring out all of these kind of modern ideas of what evidence is like, people remembering past lives, near-death experiences, and all kinds of weird phenomena that's happening in the world. And yes, all of that is good evidence, no doubt. It is evidence pointing in a certain direction. But there's one kind of evidence that we very rarely talk about, and this is the evidence that to me is by far the most important evidence, and that is that the Buddha said there is rebirth. That is what really matters to me. The reason is very simple, because the Buddha is, as I mentioned before, he's this extraordinary spiritual genius in the history of humanity. And if he says that this is true, well, surely we have very good reason to think that it must be true. Just because the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, just because he lived in a different culture, doesn't really make any difference. That gap in time is really quite irrelevant. The difference in culture is also irrelevant. What is relevant is whether he was a teacher with integrity who taught what he had discovered. And I think we have every reason to believe that that is the case. So when the Buddha says there is rebirth, actually, that is an extremely important point, and something that straight away should do something to us. At the very least, we should investigate it carefully when the Buddha says that. Why? Because we have become Buddhist out of confidence, out of a degree of faith in these teachings. And then he says, it is good that you sit together and talk about the teaching. When you're sitting together, you should do one of two things: discuss the teachings or keep noble silence. And that, in a sense, is what we are doing on a retreat like this. We are discussing the teachings, or I am presenting the teachings, maybe more accurate thing to say. And then in the evening, we have a bit more kind of discussion through questions and answers. And the rest of the time, we are keeping silence. And this is kind of exactly what we're doing here. And this is also the kind of the ideal, the monastic ideal as well. So what is noble silence? What does it mean that silence is noble? Are you keeping noble silence, or are you merely keeping silence? there is an important distinction here, because one thing is being silent, and maybe you don't really feel like being silent. Silence, or I don't want to be silent today, I want to talk to someone. That is no longer noble silence, right? Because at that moment you don't really want to be silent anymore. You feel a bit of a grudge that you have to kind of keep silent when you don't want to. You want to talk to someone. So noble silence really means that not only are you silent, but you are enjoying that silence. You're understanding the importance of silence. You do it voluntarily. In fact, not only voluntarily, but you do it also as a gift to the people around you. One of the ways that I like to think about noble silence on a retreat like this, and one way that makes it very beautiful, is if you think that I'm silent and I'm giving a gift of silence to everyone on this retreat. When you are on a retreat like this, I guarantee you there's a number of people here who will get good meditation. That is always the case on these kind of retreats. And by being silent, by living in the right way, you are giving a gift, especially to those people who are meditating deeply and having profound experiences. Because that enables these people to attain these kind of things. And so you're giving that gift to other people. And what a beautiful gift that is to give. Because this is the gift of the real results on the Buddhist path. This is helping people to attain those insights, those understandings that the Buddha is talking about. Think like that. I'm going to be silent because I want to give a gift to the people around me. And when you think like that, the silence, not only is it noble, but it comes a very powerful addition to the practice that you're doing here. Because generosity, kindness to the people around us, is such an important foundation for our practice. And if you make your whole practice a kind of act of generosity, then it becomes even more powerful than otherwise, because it gives much more easily rise to joy, rise to all of these good qualities inside of us, these qualities that actually are necessary for the meditation to work. So I would recommend you that when you meditate, not only are you keeping noble silence and supporting the people around you, but make your meditation an act of generosity. Sometimes people think that when you meditate, you are being selfish. That is a complete misunderstanding of what is going on. No, meditation is an act of service for humanity. And the reason is because when you meditate, you become a better person. You become more peaceful. You have more time for other people. You have more ability to be kind to others. Not only that, but if you have an insight into the nature of your mind and who you are as a person, you bring that wisdom and that understanding into society around you. You're bringing something valuable to the world, something really beautiful to the world. Rather than doing things on the surface, rather than doing, it's good to be kind, of course, in all kinds of ways, but this is a deeper, more profound kind of kindness that you're bringing to the world around you. So remember that when you are meditating, you're not just doing it for yourself, you're doing it for humanity, you're doing it for everyone around you, and then you are kind of bringing in a beautiful reflection into the meditation that empowers the meditation even more as a consequence. Because generosity is such an important part of this practice. So again, this is about thinking in the right way, reflecting about things in the right way. And as you do that, it kind of, the whole thing starts to unfold appropriately as a consequence. I often say to people that how do we distinguish between a worldly action and a spiritual action? And a worldly action is something that is good either for myself or for the other person. Worldly action is where you are a little bit self-centered and you're kind of a little bit greedy perhaps, and you do something for yourself. Or you do something just for the other person. In other words, you're neglecting yourself a little bit, you just do something for someone else. But a spiritual action is something that is good both for you and for the people around you. That is the spiritual action. And so when you are generous, it is good for you and also good for the other person. When you're doing meditation practice, it is good for you and also for the other person. And that is how you know that these are real spiritual qualities. So think about the noble silence in the right way. Think about the meditation in the right way. The attitude is really the critical thing here. When you get the attitude right, then your meditation is going to work as a consequence. And then the Buddha says, mendicants, there are these two searches, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? It's when someone who is themselves liable to be reborn seeks what is also liable to be reborn. Themselves liable to grow old, to fall sick, to die, to sorrow, to become corrupted, they seek what is also liable to these things. So here we have all of these things that are problematic. These are the things that are problems in the world, starting with rebirth and growing old, falling sick, dying, sorrow, becoming corrupted. We can all see why these things are problematic. So these are the things. And if we are searching for other things with the same quality, we're having the problem already within ourselves because we have to meet with these things in our life, and then we seek for other things with the same problem, then we are just compounding the problem that is already there. And that is why it is an ignoble search. Instead of finding the way out of suffering, finding the way for liberation from suffering to happiness, we are seeking more suffering in the world. And when you're seeking suffering, that is when you have the ignoble search, and that is what is going on here. Now, most of the things on that list are pretty obvious. Yeah, old age, you can see why old age is a problem, why dying is a problem, etc. But rebirth is a bit of an interesting one. Why is rebirth mentioned here? What does that actually mean? How come the Buddha is taking rebirth to be a problem? Actually, not the Buddha, this is the Buddha to be, prior to his awakening. What is actually going on with rebirth? And of course, the point here is that the Buddha to be, even before his awakening here, he understood that this was a problem. And this is kind of what makes the Buddha to be so special. Because the majority of people in the world, they would take rebirth as a bonus. Why? Because you want to exist, you want to carry on. And so you think rebirth, okay, that's good news because I don't have to kind of disappear when I die. And so for most people, there's a natural intuition or inclination of the mind towards accepting the idea of rebirth as something positive. But of course, the Buddha to be is different. The Buddha to be reflects more deeply on these things. And he understands that the consequences of rebirth, when you reflect about them properly, actually are very, very unfortunate. Why? Because if there is one rebirth, there is more rebirths. And potentially there's endless rebirths into the future. And because there's potentially endless rebirths into the future, the whole thing starts to become very unpleasant after a while. If you have done the same things again and again 1,000 times, after a while you get really fed up. And after a while you want to get off the wheel of rebirth because you understand, actually, it is not a blessing at all. It is a curse to be reborn. This is really what the Buddha to be is already seeing at this particular point. So rebirth is the problem. And you will notice that rebirth is first in the sequence. It doesn't say old age, sickness, death, then rebirth. It always starts with rebirth. And because rebirth gives you this large view of the nature of existence. So once you have been reborn, well then, the idea of sickness, old age, and death carries on into the future. And this is the problem. It is not the fact that you're going to die once that is the problem. It is the fact that it's going to happen again and again and again in the future, going around this cycle of existence on and on into the future. So arguably, instead of translating this as being reborn and then dying and getting older, maybe we should render this as being as a reborn, re-old age, re-sick, re-death, re-corruption. That is maybe the more accurate translation of this, because it is this ongoing thing which really is the problem. And that is why it starts with rebirth, because it is once rebirth is in place, that is when this whole idea of this wheel, this cycle of things, kind of becomes real. And that's how you can understand that it is the continuation of these things into the future that is the real problem. So this is what is going on here. And this is why the Buddha to be understands that there's something really problematic going on. Now, one interesting point here, which is kind of a subsidiary to everything else, you will notice here that the Buddha is taking the idea of rebirth for granted. The Buddha to be is taking it for granted. It's as if that he accepting the culture of the time. The culture of the time, obviously, there was a very prevalent belief in rebirth at that time. Not everyone believed in rebirth, but it was very prevalent. And the Buddha to be is kind of accepting that. You may think, very often when we think about the Buddha, we say the Buddha, he reflected on everything, he investigated everything, he didn't take things on board just like that. But here he seems to be taking on board the idea of rebirth without any further reflection. He just seems to be accepting it. And this is kind of the kind of argument you will often hear about the Buddha, that the idea of rebirth is not really a Buddhist idea. It is something that was accepted by the Buddha and then kind of brought into the Buddhist teaching, but actually originating from outside of the Buddhist teachings. And this is what this seems to be saying. So maybe these people who are saying the Buddha just accepted existence, maybe they are right. But not really. Because the idea here, this is a complicated issue. Not only, yes, the Buddha may have accepted this as a kind of beginning point, that there is such a thing as rebirth, but also at the same time, he also investigates it as well. So further down the track, he remembers his past lives. He asks the question whether there is such a thing as rebirth or not. And then he discovers that there is rebirth. So as always, the situation is quite complex. On the one hand, the Buddha-to-be does accept certain things from that ancient society because you have to start somewhere. You have to have certain assumptions about existence. And on the other hand, when he is ready, he also investigates it, also comes to a decision whether these things are real or not. So it's a complicated thing. And this is, I think, a more realistic way of thinking about how the Buddha-to-be reflected on this and how we dealt with ideas such as rebirth, accepting it on the one hand, investigating it on the other hand. So these are all the problems, yeah? And the problem is the seeking what has all of these problems. You are compounding what is already is a problem. And then the Buddha goes on to talk about each one of these in a little bit more detail. So let's just have a quick, just starting out with this. We're not going to get very far because time is running out. But let's just have a quick look at some of the initial things here. And what should be described as liable to be reborn? Partners and children, male and female bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants and cattle are liable to be reborn. These attachments are liable to be reborn. Someone who is tied, infatuated, and attached to such things, themselves liable to being reborn, seeks what is also liable to be reborn. So you can see here that the idea of rebirth is very similar to the ideas that we have now, even though this was prior to the Buddha's awakening. All of these various kinds of people, various kinds of animals, all of them are liable to be reborn. Why does the Buddha mention all of these animals? Well, the reason is because these are the kind of animals that were possessed by people. Yeah, people owned these animals. And because they owned them, they were attached to them. And because they were attached to them, it was a problem that they were liable to be reborn, right? Because it meant that all of these negative qualities were also an aspect of even the animals that you owned. These attachments are liable to be reborn. Now, what is the word for attachments here, I wonder? Let's see if I can find that word. Upadhi. I think you're right, actually. Wow, that's pretty impressive, Ananda. So I think that's exactly right. I think it's upadhi. So upadhi means anything that you can attach to, including the five khandhas or whatever. Yeah, there you are, upadhi, upadayo in the plural, that's exactly right. So, good. So these are things that you hold on to, things that you attach to, and all of these things are liable to be reborn. And then when you are tied, infatuated, and attached to such things, when you are tied, when you are craving for things that are liable to be reborn, that very idea of being craving for those things, that means that you are seeking what is liable to be reborn. Because craving is an act of seeking. Craving is a kind of looking for something, trying to achieve something. And that is the seeking of what is liable to be to rebirth. And because rebirth is problematic, what you are seeking is suffering itself. And that, of course, is the problem right here. So I'm going to stop there. So that is the beginning of this particular sutta, and we're going to carry on with this afternoon, but it is all for now. So please have a nice lunch together, and then at 3:00 this afternoon we will carry on.